At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify the requirements for chairing a meeting at Central Orlando Group. Saturday night speakers meeting is 1 year of continuous sobriety. Have Central as your home group and attend a group conscience meeting. My name is Kim and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kim.
And I have met all those requirements. And I'm so grateful to be able to chair. I couldn't wait to be able to chair my first meeting. You know, to have 3 months. And I just couldn't wait to do it. I had drank for so long and I just couldn't stop. And it's just like what Susan read, I tried everything. I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. Oh, I wanted to be anything but an alcoholic because that's the worst thing you could possibly be in my mind at the time. And all those other remedies and thoughts, and but you don't understand, I can't do the steps, and all those things, those excuses ran out. And alcohol just took over and just literally beat me. I was spiritually dead and almost physically dead. And that's what it took for me to become willing to come in here and ask for help. I was afraid to ask for help because I thought if I asked for help, it meant I was weak and that there was something wrong with me, that I couldn't do it on my own and all that stuff that we tell ourselves. But I came in here, I didn't care. I got a sponsor and I worked the steps. And my experience from working all the steps with a sponsor was that I changed from the inside out. And it didn't take long for the idea of a drink to solve my problems to be lifted from me. I didn't have that battle going on in my head every day. Should I drink? Shouldn't I drink? I didn't think about that anymore because I did the steps. And I found a higher power through working the steps that relieves me from alcoholism on a daily basis. And I'm so grateful. Grateful to be sober. And the first year of my sobriety, my sponsor used to tell me that she was a grateful alcoholic, and I thought that was the dumbest thing I ever heard. But today, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. And it's because I have a way of life today, and I'm happy, and I have a place to go when life gets tough, and a solution, and that I don't have to drink over anything today. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Thank you. The group asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And I chose the speaker tonight because I've heard him share for many years. And I always liked what he shared. Part of the reason I liked what he shared was because he always talked about where he came from. I know he has double-digit sobriety and he never has forgotten where he came from. And he also always shares out of the book. And I know that he works the program, and it's quite evident as I watch him, not just hear him, but I watch how he carries himself. And I can't wait to hear his story. Thanks. John.
Hi, my name is John Williams, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 13th, 1993. My home group is the College Park Triangle Group in Orlando. I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I am more than well qualified to take a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what a crowd, huh? Saturday night. All dressed up and in Alcoholics Anonymous, safe, sober, and hopefully living the solution that we have been given. So, what it was like, what happened, and what is it like now? I'd like to begin by saying that I missed out on a lot of life lessons before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those life lessons was sometimes it takes courage to live. I didn't have that courage. In order to be a successful person, and I'm not talking about money-wise, but just be able to live with yourself and live with other people, you have to have integrity. Didn't have that either. Nor did I have the faith.
Speak up.
Nor did I have the faith to carry through with my life and do what I was supposed to do. So I drank for 22 years, and I wish I could say that during my time with the bottle, I was a great person, that I did what I was going to do. I can't. I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I completely mucked up my life, and when I walked in here, I thought actually my life was going to get worse, and it didn't. It got better. But not because of what I thought I was going to get out of this. So, I'll start at the beginning. I was born in Colorado. My father was in the military. He was in the Air Force. He was a pilot. My mother was a stay-at-home housewife. I had two older sisters at the time. And they were good people. Absolutely good people. They taught me right from wrong. They were good moral people. I just chose not to listen. Basically, that's what happened. So, being in the Air Force, we moved about every 2 to 3 years. So, I was born in Colorado. Let's see, moved to Washington, D.C., then Venezuela, then Wyoming, Alabama, back to Washington, D.C. Then my father retired, and we moved to Winter Park, Florida, where I grew up. Started junior high school. Back then it was junior high school. And just briefly, if you grew up in the military, it's a good life, but it's a hard life, because you're always changing, you're always moving, and once I would make friends, I would then have to move, or they would move. So it was constant change. So instead of becoming an outgoing person, I sort of became this inwardly drawn, chubby reader who ended up, you know, just sort of hiding in books and hiding at home and not going out a lot. And when I did, I was sort of socially awkward. And we got here, and I was, let's see, I was 14, went to Maitland Junior High School and made some friends. And really some what I thought were going to be lifelong friends. Now, a little more background about my family. There's a lot of alcohol in it. Tons of alcohol. The Air Force, through the perspective of a kid's eye, which was mine, was a lot of guy talk, a lot of women in the kitchen, and a lot of bottles of alcohol. And parties that would go to 2 or 3 in the morning. I remember my 10th birthday, my parents had some friends over, my godparents, this was in Alabama. My parents got so drunk, and they got so drunk that my dad walked hand in hand down the street with my godfather, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. And they were so wobbly, but I'm not blaming my parents at all. All I'm saying is that alcohol was a norm in my family, an absolute norm. I had an uncle who was a very active alcoholic, and he was sort of my measure of what alcoholism is, because he had gone to Princeton. He was a geologist with Amoco, lived all over the world, had the big house in Connecticut, the job in New York, and by the time he was 40, he was living in a VA domiciliary in St. Pete Beach, drunk out of his mind, lost it all. That's the alcoholic, and that was my measure, okay? So as long as you kept your house, your job, your marriage, everything else, you couldn't be an alcoholic. So when I started, like, officially drinking, the drinking law was 18 in Florida at the time, my parents took me out for a drink. But by 18, that was like old hat. I had started drinking when I was 15. It was, I was in 10th grade. I was at Winter Park High School, and was at an overnight church social, Presbyterian. I'm an Episcopalian, you know, but those Presbyterians, I can tell you, the kids at least can drink. So, you know what they say about Episcopalians, when there's four gathered, there's always a fifth, ba-boom. Anyway. A friend of mine had borrowed a bottle of scotch from his dad's liquor cabinet, told us each to buy a bottle of Coke, bought the bottle of Coke, told us then to drink half the bottle, drank half the bottle, he poured the rest in with scotch, shook it up, boom, down. Now, before I go into the effect, let me tell you, I never once thought maybe I shouldn't do this. Like, no, maybe I should just go back with the other with the Presbyterians and hang out with them and maybe eat something. Never once thought, no, I'm not going to drink. So I took the first drink. It was awful. I would never recommend scotch and Coke to anyone. It burned all the way down. But what happened when it hit my stomach was, Bill Oakley used to call it that, golden moment. Everything just went away. My social insecurities went away, my shyness, suddenly I was intelligent, good-looking, and had I known the way my life would have turned out, that first drink would not have been taken. If somehow I could have had a crystal ball to say, this is what's going to happen in the next 22 years of your life until you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have said, no thanks, and put the drink down, but I didn't. The two other boys involved in this little escapade at the Presbyterian Church on Lakemont Avenue in Winter Park were retching like me, but they put it down. I wanted more. Now, I was thinking today, because, you know, getting sort of like praying about what I was going to talk about, one of those boys then went on to Davidson College, University of Miami Medical School, and became a doctor and has private practice. The other boy got his PhD in physics at Emory and now teaches at UC Berkeley and has for years. That is not my story. I have 22 years that I can't fully account for in my life. And I'm serious when I say that. I was a blackout drinker. I cannot account for periods, days, sometimes weeks of my life, because alcohol did become the solution to what the mess was of my life. So I went out with my parents on my birthday when I turned 18. We went to the Contemporary Hotel at Disney. Richard Nixon gave his I'm Not a Crook speech there that night, so I didn't get to drink. So we ended up going to a restaurant in Winter Park, and I had my first official drink with my family. I had a very unremarkable academic career at Winter Park High School. I applied to the University of Florida, was accepted the next week. That would not happen today. And went there. Now, let's see, I started in the fall of 1974 at the University of Florida. My parents dropped me off in my dorm room. We unpacked my room. We went to lunch. They left. A friend of mine from high school called, said, come over to my room. Let's have a couple beers. I did. That lasted 2 or 3 hours. He said, well, let's go rush some fraternities. Because then, fraternity rush involved beer. That's it. You would go from house to house drinking beer. So we went across the street from where his dorm room was to a fraternity called Delta Upsilon. We drank a lot of beer, and sometime that night I apparently got a bid, and I said yes to it. Don't remember too much about it. You know, they asked, I said yes. And that's the way it went. So I majored in journalism, and now it becomes interesting, because for the first time in my life, I actually did something right. Again, graduated with like a middle C. Did not set the world on fire. But I did graduate. I have a diploma that proves it. And transcripts I never want to look at again. So, no matter what you think of it, I'm 21 and I got a job at the Orlando Sentinel as a night police reporter. That's a big deal for someone who's 21 to work at the time it was the third largest newspaper in Florida, when my friends from the University of Florida were working for weeklies and with Lacucci, or, you know, the Daily in East Nowheresville, Florida. I graduated one day, and about a week later I was doing what I had set out to do, was to be a newspaper reporter. Now, I believed that I should live this way, that I should get maximum output, maximum goals, maximum results for minimal input. I should just show up, and because I am me, I'm going to go straight from being the night police reporter at the Orlando Sentinel to being the Paris correspondent for the New York Times. Nothing in between. Absolutely nothing. Like experience, talent, the ability to discern. Nope. I just show up. I have a friend named Beth N. who used to come here a lot, who no longer lives here, said that she wanted a man in a limousine to come up pick her up and save her. Well, I understand that. You know, I really do. I get it. So I'm here to tell you that if you work at night, I had the 4-to-1 shift, 4 in the afternoon to 1 in the morning shift. And so what I did was I would go to various police stations and county jails, see who was arrested, see what was going on, listen to the police scanner, write obituaries, do the weather. If there was a story breaking, I would go cover it. And then afterwards, there would be a group of editors and sub-editors who would leave and go out together, and I would go home. And I thought, well, I want to be a part of. Where are they going? Well, there was, at the time, there was a bar across the street called the Orange Quarter Motor Lodge. If you're an old-time Orlandonian, is that what it is? You may remember it. It was right across the street from the Sentinel, and it was like probably built in the 1930s and had this dingy bar. And they would either go there, or there was the high-rise, what I think it was a Howard Johnson's at the time, at Colonial and I-4 that had this bar called Harry's. That, you know, like Harry's from Ernest Hemingway, you know, Venice, you know, very exotic. And that was Nahagahyde. But they would either go across the street to the Orange Quarter Motor Lodge or to Harry's to drink. And I thought I was finally in the club when they asked me to go. Okay, so getting off at 1, drinking to 3, passing out at 3 or 3:30 if I managed to make the exit that I was supposed to get home. Sometime one night I ended up in Seminole County because I kept going, I think I'm supposed to turn here. I was so drunk. But anyway, I got away with it, I thought. Okay, so the end of the Sentinel came, let's see, that was 1978. So 1980, oh no, so then the glory day was over. I was no longer on the police beat. I was sent to the Kissimmee office. Now, it was interesting. I was supposed to cover education in Osceola County. That was an oxymoron at the time. No, seriously, it really was, because there was not a lot to do. So I started drinking in the afternoons. I would say I'm going out to go do something. I don't know. And there was a bar. What was it called? The Five Points Bar. Anyway, it was on the way out to Narcoozie or somewhere. And I would go there. And I thought it was perfectly normal. I really did. And then what happened, and the end came not with a bang, but slowly at my career at the Sentinel. Because remember, I'm thinking I'm, you know, like, really insulted now. Working in Kissimmee, covering education, drinking. I think what it was failure to launch. I really do, because I would live at home, then I would move out, move in with a friend, then, you know, we would move, then I'd move back home. It was a mess. So one time I was in the main newsroom on Orange Ave, and I overheard this conversation. In 1980, you may remember, if you were born, that Castro let out the prisons and the psych wards and all the undesirables out of Cuba, and there was the big boat brigade from Cuba to Florida. So I overheard this conversation that they needed to get two reporters straight up to Fort Walton Beach, which is near Eglin Air Force Base, because a refugee camp had just been opened, and the editors were starting to think this is going to be a huge, not only statewide story, but national story. And I heard one say, and we need a reporter who speaks Spanish. So I went, "Erk!" So I said, "I speak Spanish. I used to live in Venezuela." And they said, "We didn't know that." And I said, "I do." Well, I didn't. I just used to live in Venezuela. And I could say, "Where's the bathroom where I want another beer?" But, and I could string together curse words, but did I live in Venezuela? No. So they put me on, and I flew to Fort Walton Beach that night, and it mushroomed. Now, I was just very quickly, I have to say, so I was careful. If I was talking to someone who was Spanish-speaking, when I was with people who I knew, I would sort of take them aside and try to find someone else to translate for me, because, you know, it did have to be accurate, whatever I was writing down, or I thought it had to be accurate. I don't know if it was. Yeah, so my alcoholism wasn't just the drinking. It was my approach to life. It was that whole sense of not only entitlement, but I'm going to feel better about myself through all these outside things. And I'm going to think that I am obtaining everything I want to get, and if I don't get them, well, then I'm going to drink. Or I'm going to not like you, and I'm going to drink. Or I'm going to like you, but I'm going to use you, and I'm going to drink. There's a trend here, right? So I was outgunned by this team of reporters who I ended up working with because they did a series of stories on the impact of Florida on the national level, and I got to go to Arkansas to a refugee camp there because I spoke Spanish. So I got there, got into a car, immediately bought a six-pack, and drove in the Arkansas hills before I even thought about getting to the refugee camp because I just needed that alcohol at that point to keep me going. So at the end, it turned out to be okay. Most of my stories had to be rewritten. I was offered a job with UPI in Miami. I took it. I realized I made a mistake. I tried to get my job back at the Sentinel. I said, have a nice life. We're done. Then that didn't work out. I lived in Miami for 2 months, got fired from there. I was drinking daily by this time. So I did a geographical. You know, some people like to go to California, New York, Europe. I went to Polk County. Meaning, I went to work for the Lakeland Ledger, which is the newspaper of record in Polk County. I lived in Winter Haven because I was told I have to live in Winter Haven. Now, at the time, I just found out that it was just sold, but it was owned by the New York Times Company. So I said I work for the New York Times Company in Florida because it just made me sound better, right? Well, okay. So one thing I was really, really struggling with all this time was in my personal life. Now, when I describe myself as sort of short, pudgy, and a reader, I also didn't just say I was gay. And that was something I was really struggling with all my life. And I tried dating women. Didn't go anywhere, really. It's just like, we could be friends, but yeah, so, so I never had any steady relationship. Imagine that. And that part really fueled my drinking because I hated myself. I can't begin to tell you, if you've ever dealt with something about yourself that you just hate and it's something you can't change. And no amount of alcohol could have changed that. So in 1987, I was back here. I had to get out of Polk County. I met people who drank like me, which was scary. And then I stopped working at night. I had my job duties changed, and so I was off at 5, and I did not know what to do with that time from 5 until I went to bed. I was terrified of drinking alone. I drank alone. Terrified of it. So quickly, what happened was I got a job with, it was called Tribune Media Services. It's the syndicated division of the Tribune Company, which is based in Chicago, and moved back here. And in 1986, I moved back here. In 1987, my mother died of this disease, and it was an awful death. And the night she died, I was drunk. She was in the hospital, my family was with her, and I was drunk. What I found out is that, and that was in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that to face things in life, it does require courage sometimes. And I didn't have that courage. I did not have that courage to deal with that and some other things. So I was drunk. I stayed drunk for her memorial service here. And she was buried at West Point, where my dad graduated from. And at that point, something snapped in me. I mean, I was drinking like I was 18, but at the time I was 31. That's not normal. But I never question it. And then what I found was is that no matter what I said, I kept drinking. In other words, you know, I've heard it said time and time again in the rooms. In the morning, feeling like crap, I'm not going to do it again today, and by 5 o'clock, irritable, restless, and discontented happens again. That was my story. So I tried to stop on my own. It lasted 4 days. My sponsor says he stopped on his own for 4 years. I'm very impressed with that. Mine lasted 4 days, and I had to go back to it. I just had to, because looking back, I think I needed alcohol like I needed oxygen just to maintain. Then, let's see, 1988, I started at Rollins in a master's degree program in liberal studies. I graduated from that in 1991. I got drunk, jumped a man, we're still together. He works a very good Al-Anon program. Some people in here know him, and they can testify to that. And what happened? Well, one thing happened is that as I was like drinking, I was with a company that was slimming down. In other words, people were getting laid off, and a friend of mine and I were the only two people left in this division, and I can say her name now, it's Karen N., but at the time I did not know this. There was a celebration at the Sentinel. We went across the street. There was alcohol everywhere. I noticed she was handed a drink. She put it down. I'd never seen anyone do that. Like a full drink down. Huh. So I drank. I mean, I got smashed, went out, went downtown, didn't go back to work, blah, blah. So the next day I asked her, so what's this, you put a drink down? And she says, well, I don't drink, I'm an alcoholic. I said, you are not? She said, yes, I am. She described herself as a gin-swilling, puking, slutty alcoholic who hasn't had a drink in 12 years. Now, you know, when you're in the middle of your drinking and I'm looking at this woman who is very nicely dressed, makeup isn't running, hair isn't like that, and she's not going, blah, 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 I'm going, wow, really? And so she said, yeah. And she said that she found a way out, and that was through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, sucks being you, but she said, but anytime you want to talk to me about what happened to me, please do. Please do. She didn't say, John, you come in late, you're reeking of alcohol, you know, you're still drunk. She never said anything like that, even though she saw it. What she said was, I found a way out, and if you ever want to talk to me about it, please do. God brought this woman into my life, I'm now convinced. So that was like in April of 1993, and then we're going to flash forward to July 11th of 1993, which was a Sunday. I know this because I was at a pool party. It's hot in July in Florida, and the pool was even hotter. And the guy having the party asked me if I wanted a gin and tonic. I said, no, thank you. It's too hot. He put it down on the side of the pool, and the next thing I sort of remember was coming out of a blackout at home. I don't remember taking the first drink. I don't remember what happened. Apparently, I drove home in a blackout, very dangerously, and when I came to, what scared me, when I sort of remembered, was the fact I had said, no, I don't want to drink. That's what got me. I'd done that 20 million times before, but for some reason, this time, it was like, wow. So that was on a Sunday. Monday, I went to work. I talked to my friend a little more, and she gave me the number to the intergroup office and the hotline number, and she said, give them a call. Find out about a meeting. So I did. And what happened was, as I called, hi, this is the intergroup, may I help you? Yeah, I'm interested in going to a meeting. Well, where do you live? That's none of your business. No, I don't care where you live, but we try to get people to go to meetings near where they live. Okay. So they told me, I lived downtown at the time, and what she was telling me, which I didn't know at the time, was Central. So I said, no, I can't go to downtown. People are going to see me, you know. Never mind what I'd done in the neighborhood, but they're going to see me. So I said, are there any meetings in Winter Park? Well, yes, there is. There's a meeting right off of Park Avenue. Ooh, Park Avenue. Nice. So it's called the Greenhouse. Okay, the Greenhouse, Park Avenue. Mm-hmm. So on July 13th of 1993, my partner teaches at a local college. He was teaching that night. So I got a beer glass out. I put it on the bar. And I figured I'll try this AA thing and come home and drink about it. So I went to the meeting. And I don't know. I think some of you may have been in the original greenhouse. But even though it was off of Park Avenue in Winter Park, it was a dump. I mean, it had like holes in the walls and people smoked in it and et cetera, et cetera. But I can tell you that when I walked in and I sat down, people greeted me. Someone got me a cup of coffee. Someone gave me a big book. I don't know what the topic was that night. Couldn't tell you almost 19 years later what it was about, but I can tell you that when it came around to me, I said I'm an alcoholic. I named the name, and I think that naming the name of what it was finally put the seal on 22 years of life that was hellish, from being a 15-year-old boy in high school and taking that scotch to 22 years later saying, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Shows to me the courage that I so lacked, that for some reason I just walked in. I wish I could say that everything was peaches and cream since then, but my first 3 months of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not sure I was really in. I didn't have a home group, didn't have a sponsor, so I was mostly just undrunk. As a matter of fact, I sometimes came to Central, and this place intimidated the hell out of me, because it was when the old building was in the parking lot here, and when you walked in, there was this big pole right by the front door, which I used to sit behind. It's like the newcomer's chair, you know. No one could see you. You couldn't see anyone. And you know, I would think, how do they know I'm a newcomer, you know? Don't. And so I finally did get a home group. It was made a beginning. Some people who were very near and dear to me had started it. And then I got a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor since October of 1993. So talk about accountability. And he's also in here, so I have to tell the truth as I know it. And only then, when I got a home group and I got a sponsor and I started working the steps, did I get what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. Only then. I thought I got here because I drank to get drunk. Well, I did. But I also drank to get even. I drank because I didn't like you. I drank because I didn't like me. I drank because when I drank, I was okay with me and not okay with you. I drank because it was the only solution I could come up with to my life that made sense. And by the time I tried not to drink, I couldn't stop. So, you know, there's a clinical term for how I was in the first year, probably, because my liver enzymes went sky high once I stopped drinking. It turns out I had early stages of cirrhosis. I had medical withdrawal, and pardon the expression, I was batshit crazy. Absolutely crazy. And what I needed was experience with sobriety and being sober, not just undrunk, but sober. And in October of that year also, my home group at the time also had a roundup. Now, a roundup is an Eaton meeting where someone is a speaker, people bring food, and it's fun fellowship and a speaker. And I had the honor, and at the time I didn't know it was the honor, of hearing a woman speak named Patsy R. Patsy Rodecker. She used her last name. If you ever get a chance to hear her talk on a DVD, please do. She got sober in Orlando in 1954. I heard her in 1993. She was still sober. She was married. Her husband and she lived in Daytona Beach. He had cancer. What people did not know was she had cancer. And she said something that has stayed with me to today. She said, in order to stay sober, you have to come to a level of surrender you never thought possible. At the time, I didn't understand it. I was 4 months sober, crazy. And when she said that, I thought to myself, well, maybe that's good for you. But I'm young. I'm 37. I have life in front of me. And that's not going to be me. Well, guess what? At almost 19 years sober, I've had to come to levels of surrender I never thought possible. I'm in a weird period of my life where there's a lot of anniversaries of loss. When I was 9 years, almost 10 years sober, which would be about this time, my father died. Instead of being drunk, when I asked him in his doctor's room what's going on, he said, I'm dying. And I said, so what do you want me to do? And he gave me a specific list of what he wanted me to do. I did every one of those things. I'm here to tell you that when I first got here, I always thought the fallback position was, well, if such and such happens, I'll drink. To date, I've never had to do that. Because of being in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, good sponsorship, accountability in a home group, and the sense of being in the middle of this deal has sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to be on the outside. I've been on the inside for a long time. There's also good stuff happens. You know, good stuff, absolutely. But it's not the good stuff I thought would be the good stuff. I thought the good stuff was the goodies, the money. Well, no, in like 2012 money, I'm making what I was in 1980 money. But I know now today that that's not how I measure myself. Okay? So, integrity, doing what I have to do because I said I'm going to do it. In 1990, I met a woman. Now remember, I'm dealing with, you know, I'm not gay. So one night in a blackout, I proved it. Well. Yeah, so about 2 months later, got the phone call. I'm pregnant. Yeah. Now, I was still drinking, obviously, and this fueled my drinking like no one's business. Absolutely no one's business, because the shame and the guilt of this was beyond horrible. Then I got sober, never heard from her, and then in 1994 I was switching careers. I was getting my master's degree in mental health counseling at Rollins. There's a knock on the door. It's a process server, Orange County deputy, sir. Child support. Mm-hmm. So I never contest it, but what's the point? It's mine. She's mine. So I, in 1997, signed on the dotted line and had an income deduction order, and from 1997 to 2008, paid child support. Had to, because as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what I do. That's absolutely what I do. When I got together with my partner, actually, that's the first thing I told him was, is, you know, this is what's happened. Well, he got it, because he has children, that's okay, but I didn't expect to have children this way, but there you have it. So, never met my daughter. She's going to be 21 in August. And on Father's Day, I got a phone call, 2 in the morning. This is Sarah. Hi, Dad. That happens only here. It only happens here. We had a short conversation. I reached out to her later on that day. Haven't heard from her. I don't know if I will. But I'm here to tell you that I finally had the courage and the integrity to stand up to what I had done. And from that man who was shameful, I'm talking to a room full of people about this, not because of anything other than there may be someone out there who may be going through the same thing. May have, okay? And to get through the shame and the guilt and to get sober and to be okay with things is, for me, the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. It absolutely is a journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not know how this story is going to end. After I got off the phone with Sarah, I prayed for sobriety. I did. I was upset. I'm not going to say it was an easy phone call. I did ask God to keep me sober through this. He has. I also took the practical step of calling my sponsor. I also have been talking about it with other people in the program. Just because when I was newly sober and people would talk, there was one man who talked exactly, told my story about this situation. Exactly. I talked to him afterwards. How did you get through this sober? And he told me. So I leave you with this idea of for me, what Alcoholics Anonymous has been. A couple years ago, I was up in Washington. My stepson and his wife live up there, and they have a new baby. And I was getting ready to go to a meeting. And my stepson is on my amends list because when he was growing up, I treated him horribly. I cannot begin to tell you what a butthead I was to this young man. And now he is 32. He's mostly known me sober. So I'm getting ready to go, and they turn to me, and they say, "So why do you still go to Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Well, because it's where I stay sober." But then he said, "But you're not an alcoholic, you don't drink." I said, "Well, that's true, but and you're right, I don't drink, but I'm still an alcoholic." "Well, we don't think you're an alcoholic." And he said, so it started going back, "Well, I am, you're not, I am, you're not." And I finally said, "I'm going to a meeting, I am, I love you all, bye." And you know, to hear the stories that I've heard in my time here, and to know the people who have stuck here, because I know people who don't stay here, and there's one person from my home group went out and had a hideous death. There's another man who I used to work for who at 18 years sober died of this disease. And then there was another woman from my home group who stayed sober and died of another illness. But she was sober. And people in my home group were with her when she died. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. So I came in here frightened thinking my life is over. Well, I really think that my life was just starting. As I said earlier, you know, I cannot fully account for 22 years of my life, but I can account for 19 years of it. And I can tell you that, you know, I got some other things going on in my life right now, but if I put it on a different way of thinking, I'm okay. I'm really okay. And I'll end by saying that part of my disease was that awful, awful loneliness that I have not experienced. And that awful aloneness of having no direction in my life and no one to talk to, or at least I thought. I have that today. And I had a medical issue last fall. I have a tumor in my right leg, in the leg, and there was a period of time when my oncologist thought it may be cancer. And people of Alcoholics Anonymous rallied. Took me to meetings, brought me here, took me home, called me, helped my partner. I had marked this, you know, the whole thing about in the, you know, one of the stories. Now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we've been given the keys of the kingdom. And that's true. We have been. So, to quote someone else in this room, I'm a satisfied customer. And that's my story, and I'm going to stick to it. So thanks.